loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we discuss remarks by Donald Trump on national TV that U.S. forces would remain in Iraq, despite what he calls the defeat of ISIS. They will remain, he says, in order to watch Iran. We're going to talk about how this is playing out in Iraq and in the region. And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Venezuelans are being forced to consider the possibility of civil war, as major European Union countries today recognized Juan Guaido as president and huge street mobilizations, both in favor of and opposed to the government of President Nicolas Maduro, took place. Next, Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard formally announced her candidacy for president on Saturday. Her campaign is off to a rough start because of internal dissent, but her problem may be bigger than that. Is there room for an anti-war Democrat in the presidential race? Then, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then, French President Emmanuel Macron is expected to call for a national referendum to reduce the size of government in an effort to stem increasingly large yellow vest protests across the country. That would take place in May, at the same time as elections for the European Parliament. At the same time, however, Macron has authorized police to fire rubber bullets at unarmed protesters, causing serious injuries and inflaming still more would-be protesters. Yellow vest leaders have called an assembly of assemblies, that is, yellow vest leaders from around the country, to discuss next steps. And finally, the truce in the U.S. trade war with China ends on March 2nd, when additional sanctions will go into effect absent a new trade agreement. President Trump says that a, quote, great deal, unquote, is in the works, but he may have to fight anti-China hawks in his own cabinet to come to such an agreement. And in other headlines, Nayib Bukele won yesterday's presidential election in El Salvador, defeating the governing Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, as well as the main right-wing party, ARENA. Bukele used to be an FMLN member, but ran in the election as a candidate of a center-right party. This will be the first time since the end of the country's civil war in 1992 that a party other than ARENA or the FMLN will govern. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam is facing increasing pressure to resign over a racist medical school yearbook photo. The photo on Northam's page depicted one person in blackface and another wearing a Ku Klux Klan outfit. So far, Northam has insisted that he will remain in office. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen has agreed to testify before the House Homeland Security Committee on March 6th. Negotiations over her testimony were contentious, and the House was on the verge of issuing a subpoena to compel Nielsen to testify. The hearing is expected to focus on the Trump administration's hardline anti-immigrant policies. U.S. Special Envoy for Korea Negotiations, Stephen Bagan, met with South Korea's National Security Advisor today. The meeting reportedly focused on preparations for the Trump-Kim summit that is expected to take place later this month. Bagan, Secretary of State Pompeo, and other officials have been engaged in a wide range of consultations in the run-up to the summit. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the continuing U.S. presence in Iraq. President Trump caused consternation in Baghdad over the weekend when he said that he may leave U.S. troops in Iraq to, quote, watch Iran. Those U.S. troops have been in Iraq fighting ISIS, or at least that's what the American people were told. The problem is that the president never asked the Iraqi government's permission to leave those troops in Iraq to be able to, quote, watch Iran. We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirande. He is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammed Mirande, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me again.
Thank you for joining. Mohammed, I want to start with a few audio clips from Donald Trump when he was on Face the Nation over the weekend. Let's start with the first one. It's about 12 seconds long. Let's listen.
I want to be looking a little bit at Iran because Iran is a real problem.
Whoa, and that's news. You're keeping troops in Iraq because you want to be able to strike in Iran?
No, because I want to be able to watch Iran.
Okay, he wants to watch Iran, so why not have Iraq as a perch? Let's listen to a second clip from the same interview.
We have an unbelievable and expensive military base built in Iraq. It's perfectly situated for looking at all over different parts of the troubled Middle East.
And because we love to listen to Donald Trump so much, we're going to hear a third short, brief audio clip from that same interview.
We're going to keep watching and we're going to keep seeing. And if there's trouble, if somebody's looking to do nuclear weapons or other things, we're going to know it before they do.
Okay, that's also interesting. Mohamed Mirandi, go ahead.
I think the problem, of course, is that by making these statements, the United States is, and Trump is hurting U.S. relations with Iraq and Iraqis. He's humiliating the Iraqi government because they don't recognize the U.S. presence as being a presence to monitor a neighboring country. And they humiliate the Iraqi government in the eyes of Iraqis who do not want their country occupied by the Americans. Americans, according to polls, are very unpopular in Iraq. And this has been consistent for a very long time. So this only makes things worse. On the other hand, I don't think that the Iranians feel vulnerable to the Americans. After all, the Americans have around 40 bases surrounding Iran, and they have a huge naval presence in the Persian Gulf region. In fact, what Iraq is, in my opinion, is the U.S. presence in Iraq, I think, is a liability for the United States because it only makes them vulnerable to Iraqis who are unhappy with American presence. And we've seen a number of Iraqi groups already threaten the Americans with the military strike. So it's a foolish statement, and it doesn't achieve anything, and it also makes American troops vulnerable.
John, you know, one thing is that Donald Trump has no experience, nor does he want to take any direction from others who have experience, not about, you know, what the real essence of the issue, because perhaps Trump has got his finger on it. He wants to keep U.S. troops in Iraq because it's a projection of American power in this geostrategically important and resource-rich part of the world. He says, of course, it's to watch Iran. But, you know, maybe that is the actual present, the real reason for the U.S. presence there. But Donald Trump, you know, he says things that a, quote, normal U.S. president wouldn't say just because of diplomatic protocols. Now we have a situation in Iraq where a proud people, a people with a long history, a people who are also resentful about living under occupation and having suffered so much as a consequence of the invasion of 2003, when they hear the president of the United States saying, yeah, we're just going to occupy your country so that we can watch others, we can project American power against Iran, it's created a huge backlash.
Well, it's like when he said during the campaign that he wanted to take Iraq's oil to pay for the U.S. war there. He says things that are patently illegal without giving them a second thought. And I think you're right, Brian. I think in part it's because he is not a professional politician. He's never done this kind of thing before. And where some politicians might think one way, they wouldn't actually open their mouths and allow the words to come out. He does that all the time.
Yeah, so Mohammed, is it possible that just the unsophisticated character of the current occupant of the White House actually is just sort of in a way telling the truth?
Well, the United States has behaved in such a manner for decades. It's not as if other American presidents have not invaded other countries, and they haven't done it for the sake of oil or natural resources or for hegemony. But Trump is he doesn't understand the language of politics. He's also very inconsistent. So, for example, what we see in Venezuela now runs in contrast to what he's been saying about Iraq, about Syria, and about Afghanistan. So now he's threatening to send troops to Venezuela. Whether he does that or not is another thing altogether. But the very fact that he is willing to contemplate that shows that there is no consistency in the way in which he speaks or conducts himself.
Mohamed Mirandi is our guest. Mohamed is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. We're talking about the U.S. role in Iraq, especially in the aftermath of Donald Trump's appearance on Face the Nation on Sunday morning TV talk shows, where he said he was going to keep U.S. troops, and there are thousands of them, in Iraq so that the U.S. could, quote, watch Iran. And we're talking about what the political fallout of that is in Iraq. Again, Mohammed, inside the Iraqi parliament, we're hearing reports that there are initiatives being undertaken at the parliamentary level as a consequence of this interview to demand that the U.S. troops actually leave Iraq. What are you hearing?
It's unclear where that is going to go, because the Americans are going to put pressure on Parliament not to take such steps, and the Americans will probably have to give some concessions to make sure that they aren't humiliated by the Iraqi Parliament. And I think probably what we will see, though, is that the Iraqis, in order to show goodwill to Iran, they'll probably be giving concessions to Iran as a result of Trump's statement. And Trump will probably have to give some sort of concession to Iraq in order to prevent the parliament from pushing too hard. It's hard to say, because the Iraqi parliament is very fragmented. There are many factions. There's no majority. The majority that exists in the Iraqi parliament is based on a very broad and fragmented series of coalitions and parties, and a mixture of it's coalitions of coalitions. So it's difficult to say what will happen in parliament. But some of the most harsh statements have been coming from Muqtada Sadr's faction. And they're the ones who the Americans were trying to lobby to help bring a prime minister to power that was closer to the United States. Ultimately, the Americans failed, and both the prime minister, the president, and the speaker of parliament, actually all three of them, those who were chosen, are close friends of Iran. But Sadr's coalition was one of those coalitions that the Americans were hoping to get closer to, but they've been using the harshest language around for their response to Trump.
Interesting sort of juxtaposition, given the orientation earlier, both of al-Sadr's forces and the U.S. towards him and his movement back, say, in 2004, when he was helping to lead what was then they were based in parts of the population. At least the language of the opposition was such that it would seem to be seeking at least to unify all Iraqis, regardless of whether one was Shiite or Sunni. And there was armed clashes between al-Sadr's militias and the U.S. forces. How did it come to be that the U.S. would see him ultimately as the preferred option for the Iraqi government? Not he himself, but for people who would be brought to authority based on his support.
Out of a sheer hatred and contempt for Iran. That's how U.S. policy works in this region. Full of inconsistencies, they're willing to go to bed with the devil, they're willing to get in bed with the devil, they're willing to carry out any policy with any person or any organization as long as they see that it can somehow hurt Iran. That's one of the problems that the Americans have, because that is probably the main problem that the Americans have, because these coalitions, these alliances simply don't function.
This goes back to the short-sightedness of U.S. foreign policy. The JCPOA was working. We've said that 1,000 times.
That's the Iran nuclear arms deal.
The Iran nuclear arms deal was working. It's still working, actually, even though the United States has withdrawn. Now, if we had remained in that deal, we wouldn't have these ridiculous multi-billion dollar expenses. We wouldn't have a president being criticized for announcing in a nationally televised interview that he's going to commit an impeachable act by committing troops without congressional authorization and violating the sovereignty of an allied country. We wouldn't have any of these problems. We wouldn't have to tell parents, we want to put your children in harm's way just because ideologically we don't want to be friends with the government of Iran. And nobody seems to care.
That's an important point of this discussion. You know, there is really, even though there's a lot of continuity between presidents, or just minor tweaking. The abrogation of American commitment to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal, and in fact, going in the opposite direction of imposing sanctions in violation of that agreement that the U.S. signed with Iran and other countries, this is really a profound shift in U.S. policy. Not that Obama was not hostile to Iran, but it was Obama that who took the initiative to, on the American side, they have the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Anyway, what about that in terms of where Trump can be located within the American political establishment? It seems to me that there's not a lot of voices within the Washington establishment, be they Democratic or Republican, who are actually chastising Trump on his Iran, his complete animus towards Iran. Go ahead, Mohammed.
Well, I think you're both right, but there's a sort of paradox in U.S. policy. On the one hand, Obama, after years of hostility towards Iran, I think he recognized that he can't undermine the country, and that it is in American interest to spend less energy constantly antagonizing Iran. And I think that it was partially because of the so-called shift to Asia or shift towards China, where the Americans wanted to put more focus on China. So Obama wanted to ease tensions here. But beyond that, I don't really see a major difference between Obama and Trump, because what Trump, for example, is doing now in Venezuela, Obama and his European allies did in Syria, but even more similar to what we see in Venezuela is what happened in Libya, and how the Europeans and Americans worked together to undermine a government that was internationally recognized. They destroyed the country. They helped murder the leader, whether one likes him or not. Now we just have a broken country where slaves are bought and sold, and tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people use Libyan soil to cross or to attempt to cross over the Mediterranean to get to Europe out of sheer desperation. And because the Europeans are making it so difficult, many of them drown in the Mediterranean on a regular basis. So what we see in Venezuela, for example, and Trump's extraordinarily, it's this 19th century European and American attitude towards Venezuela, is something that we saw in Syria and in Libya and in Yemen, in this part of the world, during the previous administration.
Mohammed Mirandi is our guest. Mohammed, I want to play a couple audio clips from President Barack Obama. The first clip is from October 21st, 2011, where he's announcing the full withdrawal of U.S. troops. It's very brief. Of course, he had campaigned in 2008 to end the war in Iraq. And so this is Obama. Again, it's really remarkable. It's 7 years, 3 months ago. Let's start with this clip. And then I'm going to play a second clip from Obama that's from 2014 as U.S. troops are being sent back to Iraq. But let's listen to the first clip.
So today, I can report that, as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year. After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over.
America's war in Iraq will be over. Important words,
that's
right?
Great.
That was October 21st, 2011. Now let's listen to Obama speaking on June 13th, 2014, about a little less than three years later. Let's listen.
In the face of a terrorist offensive, Iraqi security forces have proven unable to defend a number of cities, which has allowed the terrorists to overrun a part of Iraq's territory. And this poses a danger to Iraq and its people. And given the nature of these terrorists, it could pose a threat eventually to American interests as well. Now, this threat is not brand new. Over the last year, we've been steadily ramping up our security assistance to the Iraqi government with increased training, equipping, and intelligence. Now, Iraq needs additional support to break the momentum of extremist groups and bolster the capabilities of Iraqi security forces. We will not be sending U.S. troops back into combat in Iraq, but I have asked my national security team to prepare a range of other options that could help support Iraq security forces, and I'll be reviewing those options in the days ahead.
Mohamed Mirandi, that was President Obama 3 years after announcing the Iraq war for the U.S. is finally over, and then announcing June 13th, well, no, actually, thousands of U.S. troops are going to come back to Iraq. He says they're not going to play a combat role, but of course, that's just rhetoric. Anyway, that was following the collapse of the Iraqi military's hold in the city, the large city in northern Iraq of Mosul. Just take us back there and talk about the significance of what happened.
Well, there are two things, really. One is that the Americans and their regional allies like Saudi Arabia and Turkey, Israel, the Emirates and Qatar, they all began funding extremist groups in Syria. And one of those groups ended up being ISIS, which was Al-Qaeda beforehand. And ISIS grew, and the United States used ISIS against Syria. Well, we have, as I'm sure you know, the leaked audio of former Secretary of State Kerry, where he told some of these Syrians who work with Americans that we allowed ISIS to move close to Damascus to put pressure on President Assad. And interestingly, so this monster that the Americans helped create, the spillover went into Iraq. And when they began to advance in Iraq, actually, when the Iraqi government asked Obama for support, according to an interview that Obama gave later on, he admitted, or well, he said that the United States did not give the Iraqi government the aid that they needed and the air support that they needed in order to put pressure on the Iraqi government in order to remove the prime minister. They wanted someone else to replace Maliki. So they were allowing ISIS to advance on Baghdad so that they could get their way and have a new prime minister in the country. That's how Obama functioned. So the creation of ISIS was due to U.S. policy and the policy of their friends in the region. The advance, the United States allowed ISIS to advance on Damascus, so says Kerry. And Obama says that the United States allowed ISIS to advance on Baghdad so that they could get their way with the Iraqi government. And ironically, of course, the evil Iranians, as usual, it was they who had to send troops to Iraq to prevent the fall of Baghdad, to prevent the fall of Erbil. And the Iranian Air Force was bombing ISIS positions 24 hours a day. Iranian troops were based across the board in Iraq, embedded among Iraqi army soldiers and Iraqi volunteers to hold the extremists back. And of course, the United States takes credit for destroying ISIS.
That's the voice of Mohamed Mirandi.
It happens all the time, doesn't it?
The level of cynicism is so profound. And again, because Americans are getting their news from outlets like the Washington Post, which is all about U.S. imperial domination over every country, they hate Trump. But if Trump is going to overthrow Venezuela, they're good with it. If Trump sends cruise missiles to Syria over a false allegation about chemical weapons, they're good with that. They say he's starting to act presidential. As long as he dips his hands in enough blood in the countries of targeted countries, they're all good with it. And here you have Obama. Mohamed Mirandi is telling us he's okay with ISIS moving on Iraqi cities because it puts pressure on the Maliki government, because the U.S. wanted to have a government in Baghdad that would be another government, a different government. But then maybe it's just the unintended consequences of all of this hubris and arrogance, because it seemed to me, Mohamed, that the U.S. was truly alarmed about the fall of Mosul and then the offensive by ISIS, which looked like, if it had advanced on Baghdad, would not be not simply a tragedy for Iraqis, but then like American assets were being undermined. And then it seems like the U.S. changed, Obama changed, sprung into action, et cetera, et cetera. Also true, or do you see it differently?
No, I think that is true. I think that he was, on the one hand, delaying a U.S. response and allowing ISIS to move forward so that he could put pressure on Baghdad to get his prime minister or to get this prime minister removed. But at the same time, if Baghdad would have fallen, then Obama would have been humiliated because the previous administration, which has created the disaster in the first place, they would have said, and Obama's critics would have said, you've lost Iraq by pulling out. Whereas the reality, of course, is not that Iraq would have fallen because of the U.S. pulling out. Iraq would have fallen because the United States and its allies created ISIS in the first place. They created Al-Qaeda and ISIS and Jaish al-Islam and Ahrar al-Sham in Syria in order to destroy the Syrian government because they were antagonistic towards it. And the consequences were the spillover in Iraq.
Mohamed Barani, we only have about 3 minutes left. I want to play our last audio clip. It's from that same day, June 13th, 2014. Again, it's President Obama, and I want to contrast his comments with President Trump's comments yesterday on Face the Nation, or see if you think of it this way. Let's listen.
Now, Iraq's neighbors also have some responsibilities to support this process. Nobody has an interest in seeing terrorists gain a foothold inside of Iraq, and nobody is going to benefit from seeing Iraq descend into chaos.
Now, that's Obama. He's already initiated the process for negotiations with Iran and other countries that ultimately led to the Iran nuclear arms deal, the JCPOA. He's basically, it sounds to me like saying, hey, we, the United States, now in the face of this ISIS offensive, actually need to cooperate at some level with Iran, if that's who he's referring to when he talks about the responsibility of Iraq's neighbors. Contrast that with Trump's comments yesterday. We're staying in Iraq to watch Iran.
Well, you're right. But first of all, when at about the time when the negotiations began in earnest, I think during Lauzon, that's when the Americans gave the green light to the Saudis to attack Yemen. So that was a new tragedy unfolding at that time. But you know, there are so many inconsistencies in both Trump and Obama. Obama antagonized Iran for years. Then when ISIS was getting out of control, he wanted Iranian cooperation so they helped create this monster. Then when it got out of control, they wanted some sort of Iranian cooperation. But on the other hand, they allowed the Saudis to create this slaughter in Yemen. Trump, on the other hand, he wants to pull out of Syria and Afghanistan. Then he sends troops to Iraq. He wants to take them home, but then they go to Iraq and now he threatens Venezuela. So these inconsistencies have always been a part of U.S. foreign policy in all administrations, whether they're politically correct people like Obama or politically incorrect people like Trump. But the problem is, of course, American exceptionalism and Eurocentrism, where they seem to think that they have exceptional rights, that they're more civilized. So if they make a decision in Venezuela or anywhere else in the world, they have the right to do so. And they have the right to disregard international law.
That was the voice of Mohamed Mirandi. He talked to us from Tehran, Iran. He is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, welcome back.
As always, great to be back.
You know, in our description of this segment called Technology Rules, we use the words, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. They're also censoring. A lot of censorship is going on, and it's not willy-nilly, it's directed. It's against progressive and alternative media. Let's start with this story.
Yeah, two big stories this morning. So last week, Thursday, Twitter said it was deleting 2,000 pro-Venezuelan accounts. Twitter, of course, in recent history has gone, you know, we remember they've deleted accounts that they say were based in Russia, Iran, and a few other countries. But it's super interesting, right? As Venezuela is top of the news cycle for the most part, as the U.S. is pushing for regime change, as the EU is, you know, supporting that, that Facebook and Twitter both are now turning their attention to Venezuelan accounts that are supporting the government of Nicolas Maduro and against the coup and potential military intervention by the United States. So, yeah, from Venezuela analysis, which itself, by the way, has been a target of censorship on social media platforms. This article is Twitter erupts after 2,000 pro-Venezuelan accounts are deleted. So this is, you know, and Twitter again, they say, oh, Russia, Iran, and Venezuela now, but they only added Venezuela just last week to their list of targets as the U.S. is pushing for this military, for this coup and potential military intervention. Also very important to note, there is an article, there's Granma, which is a Cuban, they call themselves, they are the official voice of the Communist Party of Cuba's Central Committee. They posted an article called Venezuela is Not Alone. It's a very good solidarity statement. Well, I went to post this on Facebook this morning, and I have seen that a bunch of other people went to post this as well. Facebook first says, this is spam. Are you sure you want to post it? And if you confirm, they say, this post goes against our community standards, so no one else can see it.
Oh my God.
This is a post from Cuba, from the Communist Party of Cuba, on their English website, saying that Venezuela is not alone. But of course, Facebook is doing its part to marginalize and to isolate Venezuela and the Venezuelan people as they defend their sovereignty.
You know, I mean, people have been reading Granma newspaper, whether you like the Cuban Revolution or don't.
Yeah.
Granma newspaper has been a staple of like international media evaluation because it's the newspaper of Cuba. And if Cuba is a major player in Latin America, Cuba is a major player in global politics, an outsized role for an island, small island nation. But here's Facebook. Now, you can, if you can find the article by going to Google, right? So far, anyway, you can put in a search term. You can put Granma, Venezuela. That article will come up. But according to Facebook, even though you can get it from elsewhere on the social on social media, it somehow violates Facebook's community standards for people to be able to read it. I mean, how is that? Just think about that for a second.
Yeah, it's anti-democratic.
We can find it online, but Facebook won't share it with people because it violates community standards. Now, whose community standards? Cubans, Venezuelans, Uruguayans, Mexicans, Bolivians. I mean, those governments and those most of those people are standing with the current government in Venezuela. So who, what do we mean by community standards?
Well, that's interesting, because if you go back to Twitter's statement about these Venezuelan accounts, they say they had been using social media to disseminate government talking points. Well, I checked this morning, Brian and John, real Donald Trump still has an account. The White House has an account. POTUS is still there. Press Secretary and State Department are still there, and they certainly are disseminating government talking points on Twitter. So it's pretty clear, right, whose community standards these are. These are the international ruling class standards. These are the standards of the State Department, of the White House, of U.S. and Western capital that cannot stand to see the Venezuelan people determine their own destiny and the Cuban people in solidarity with them.
Yeah, it does demonstrate the so-called Russiagate easily morphs to other issues whereby the U.S. government targets anybody who has an alternative or different point of view from the government's point of view is somehow, you know, some demon interfering in or meddling in our democracy or violating our community standards. So it's Russia months ago, then it could be China, then it could be Iran, then it could be Venezuela. Now it's Cuba. You're living in the free world, everybody, but don't you dare think that you can actually share things from governments or social media or people who live in the parts of the world that the free world says is not part of the free world, meaning if you're independent of the U.S. dictates.
And it's still Russia, Brian. You know, the New York Times has an article from a few days ago saying Russia's playbook for social media disinformation has gone global. And that's where they have this quote about, you know, Venezuela using social media to disseminate government talking points. They're still bringing it back to Russia. Russia has nothing to do with this, but it's all Russia, Russia, Russia.
The anti-Russia campaign is a gateway drug, John. I mean, that's what Chris is telling us. It's a gateway drug. Once you start smoking from that pipe, the Russia pipe, you're going to start thinking, well, yeah, this the same goes for Venezuela, Cuba, Korea, Iran, you name it. you name it. And also, I want to go back to the dimensions. As you said, they're all the other countries are borrowing from the Russian playbook. You know, what was the Russian playbook? What was it exactly? Again, remember the indictments from Robert Mueller are against that clickbait firm that's trying to, you know, sell ads,
yeah.
The IRA, Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg. I'm looking again at Aaron Mate's really excellent article in The Nation about the overstatement about the significance of any so-called Russian meddling. And again, the IRA is not the Russian government, although these distinctions don't matter anymore.
Not in the mainstream
media. As long as you're Russian. But here's what Aaron Mate points out about the power of the Russian playbook. Also hurting the case, this is from Aaron Mate, The Nation, also hurting the case that the Russians reached a large number of Americans is that they spent such a microscopic amount of money to do it. Oxford, one of the agencies that is exposing the IRA, puts the IRA's Facebook spending between 2015 and 2017, that's 3 years, at $73,711. As was previously known, about $46,000 of that was spent on Russian-linked Facebook ads before the 2016 election. So $46,000. That amounts to 0.05% of the $81 million spent on Facebook ads by the Clinton and Trump campaigns combined. A recent disclosure by Google that Russian-linked accounts spent how much? Do you remember the number on Google platforms?
Yeah, what was it? $50,000 or something like that?
No, it was $4,700
in
2016. They're coming at us. It only underscores, as Aaron Mate says, how minuscule the spending was. The researchers also claim that the IRA's, quote, manipulation of American political discourse had a budget that exceeded $25 million in U.S. dollars. But that number is based on the widely reported error that mistakes the IRA spending on U.S.-related activities for its parent project's overall global budget, including domestic social media activity in Russia and also salaries.
Mm.
This is minuscule. This is nothing. But this has been developed as the playbook. Now Venezuela is borrowing from the Russian playbook, and that's why Twitter is going to shut down accounts that if they defy the Trump administration's logic about Venezuela or their narrative, their propaganda. And now same Facebook shutting down, not allowing Facebook users to share an article from Granma, the Cuban newspaper. I mean, it really shows the global character of this witch hunt.
And you see there's a trend here. This is getting worse and worse and worse. Every time we talk about this issue, it's worse than the previous time. So this is a real trend. Regardless of what the issues are in this coming campaign, they're going to make Russia the issue, whether it really is or not.
And I can remember the way what you're saying, John, is so true. We started this show Loud and Clear as the first radio show out of the Sputnik studio here in Washington. That was in December, end of December 2015, right? So it'll be 4 years come December 2019. Now, we had no idea during this entire early part of the cycle, the dimensions to which this Russia thing could go. Because first of all, nobody considered Donald Trump to be a viable candidate because it all came around the Trump campaign. Also, anybody who listened to this show, Loud and Clear, would know that we were virulently anti-Donald Trump. I mean, we weren't supporters of Hillary Clinton, but we were lambasting Trump all the way, constantly. And more than that, our show at that time wasn't even on terrestrial radio. It was just an internet show. So during this entire time, we were doing anti-Trump shows, not on radio, only online. And then the second show that came on, by any means necessary, likewise, a progressive show that was highlighting all of the terrible policies of Donald Trump. And yet here we are in 2019. Three years, 2 months later, and somehow Sputnik and RT and the Russian playbook, basically through these media outlets, has so impacted the American political situation and system that it's now perhaps the decisive factor. I mean, it's just such nonsense.
No, Brian, I think you absolutely hit the nail on the head. And this is not, unfortunately, going away. People need to be able to find and actively search out alternative news outlets and media. Aaron Mate is great. Venezuela Analysis is great. Granma. All of these, people need to be looking for these to stay up on what is actually happening, not just what the New York Times, Washington Post, and State Department want us to be reading.
Yeah, and before we go to the next story, I just, for people who want to find Aaron Mate's analysis, which is great, it was published in The Nation on December 28th, 2018. The headline is, "New Studies Show Pundits Are Wrong About Russian Social Media Involvement in U.S. Politics." Subtitle, "Far from being a sophisticated propaganda campaign, it was small, amateurish, and mostly unrelated to the 2016 election." Aaron Mate, December 28th, 2018. Chris, let's go on to our next story.
Well, let's move over to San Francisco now. There is a proposed bill in San Francisco. It's called the Stop Secret Surveillance Ordinance. It's going to go in front of the Board of Supervisors there, and it was proposed by Supervisor Aaron Peskin. So by the name, it sounds pretty good, right? Stop Secret Surveillance Ordinance. And on the surface, what it would do, what the news coverage is saying about it, is that it's going to stop any government-based facial recognition technology use in the city of San Francisco. That would be really fantastic. But when you actually look at the ordinance as proposed, it doesn't do that. All it does is say that government agencies need to go to the Board of Supervisors in order to get permission to use any sort of facial recognition technology, to purchase it, to use it. But there's also a cutout for, you know, emergency circumstances. So the police, for example, could say anything was an emergency circumstance and acquire or use facial recognition technology they've already acquired. Another thing in here is that, you know, there's supposed to be a yearly report to the year to the Board of Supervisors about any use of facial recognition technology. But here's the problem. It says, "An annual surveillance report shall not contain specific records that a surveillance technology item collects, stores, exchanges, or analyzes." So they can say that, yeah, we use this, but they can't say what they collected and what they're doing with it. So while this bill could be, you know, could have been very good, this bill could have been great. It does almost nothing. The one thing it will do is it will create a paper trail of when government agencies in San Francisco do apply to use it. And if it does pass, I would encourage folks in San Francisco and in the Bay Area to pay attention to that. But it is not the cure for privacy woes for facial recognition.
And I have a privacy question for you, Chris, dealing with facial recognition. When you go to an airport now, of course, you see the regular security line, you see the TSA pre line where pre-cleared people go to a shorter line. But now you also see this line for something called Clear. Now, for $99 a year, you can sign up for Clear. They take your fingerprints right there in the airport one time. And then any other time you go to the airport or to a stadium for a sporting event or a concert, anywhere you see a sign that says Clear, you go into this very short line, they scan your eyes, and you're in. What's bad about that? Is that not convenient for everyone? Does it really matter that they have a retinal scan of us that identifies us? What are the pros and cons there?
Well, I mean, as somebody who does fly regularly but isn't going to apply for this, it would be nice, right, to be able to just kind of go right through, you know, those lines. However, no, they're putting this information about you into a database, right? And you don't know what else it's being used for. You don't know who else is requesting access to it, getting access to it, if the information has been leaked, if there are any other issues with that. And I think this actually goes right into our next story, too. This is coming from BuzzFeed. One of the biggest at-home DNA testing companies is working with the FBI.
With the FBI, that's right.
Yes, Family Tree DNA. So, you know, they send you that little kit and you swab your, you know, the inside of your cheek and you send it back to them and it tells you, oh, you know, your family is X percent from, you know, Italy, X percent from wherever. You know, you may be genetically predisposed to these illnesses. You know, things that people like want to know, right? But they're working with the FBI. In these. And so, you know, and we already know that the FBI has actually used public genealogy databases to solve cold cases. The most famous of these was the case of the Golden State Killer. And it wasn't even his DNA. It was his, I believe, his brother's.
Yes, it was a relative. That's right.
But a close enough genetic match. So to go back to your question, John, is you don't know where, you know, does TSA use a private contractor to store this information? How is that, you know, what is that private contractor being held responsible? Are there audits of what they're doing with this information? Can you have your information removed if you want to? These are all questions in privacy that we don't get answers to, especially when private companies are involved, but also with public government agencies.
And this is a private company, is it not? We're not talking about a governmental entity here.
That's right. So with Family Tree DNA, this is a private company. And again, this is, you know, this is something like the science here is amazing, right? Some of the bits where it tells you where your family lineage may be from, those actually end up not being as accurate as they make them out to be. And there is more work to be done there. You know, but having said that, there are many people for whom this is a very interesting question and could be very personally important to them. Particularly, you know, I myself, I've thought about doing these. I am adopted and I don't know much about my birth family. Would love to know, but I'm not sending my DNA to some private company to know who's, you know, to, where there's no transparency and no clarity. And then we find out now they're working with the FBI. You know, we should be able to use these, you know, these services, and we should be able to get this information without, first of all, having to pay so much money, and second, without, you know, having to worry about what's happening to our information here.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Now, this Clear thing, is that also a private company, Chris, or is this something that's sponsored by whomever, TSA, DHS? Where does this come from?
No, that is sponsored by TSA. You know, it's not clear immediately how they are storing, if the TSA itself is storing your information, or if it's a private company storing that information. And I think this would be an interesting research project that somebody should take on. But no, this is TSA Clear is a public, you know, Transportation Security Administration, Homeland Security program.
Chris, let's go on to the next story.
Okay, so let's move on here. So, you know, we talk a lot about owning our data, right? But this is not what we meant. Facebook got in some trouble here. Facebook was basically paying teenagers $20 a month to install software on their phone that spied on them. There's been, you know, many, many layers to this story. The top one, first of all, being that Facebook is paying people to let them be spied on. But also, you know, once Apple found out about this software, it shut down Facebook's access to distribute certain software. So Apple had actually shut down this software a few months ago. Facebook went around Apple's policies and started not distributing this in the App Store, but providing a way around Apple's App Store for people to install this software. Now, that is a violation of Apple's terms and services for their developer program, right? You're not allowed to do that. You have to go through the App Store. So once Apple found out Facebook was doing this, especially after Apple had said, you can't distribute this software, they shut off Facebook's access to publish software that was internal to Facebook, right? So you might have heard that, like, Facebook employees couldn't, you know, order lunch in the office. That's not an app that Facebook is going to publish to the world, but they give Facebook employees access to it. Well, Apple shut down all of Facebook's internal publishing tools because of this. That has been since turned back on. So two main concerns here, right? First of all, Facebook completely, blatantly went against what had already happened and went and distributed this spy app to teenagers who don't understand, for the most part, what it means to have your usage habits, your internet habits spied on. But second of all, you know, we also have to talk about this fact that Apple actually has so much control. If you have an iPhone, Apple has so much control over what you can and can't install on your phone. It can remove an app from your phone if it chooses to. And, you know, this is a trade-off, right? It's a trade-off in terms of, you know, Apple not allowing certain types of spying software, buggy software, things like that. But ultimately, you should have control over what goes on your phone. So many, many layers to this very interesting story here.
Yeah, Chris Garaffa is our guest. We talk to Chris every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules. It's a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties, and as we discussed in the early part of this segment, how it's also involved, as is Twitter, in carrying out political censorship, especially against progressive media and alternative voices. I want to follow up on this story a little bit. They're talking about 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds. How does that work? I mean, do the parents know?
And how can they even legally make a decision to allow a giant corporation like Facebook to spy on them? They're not of legal age to be able to enter into a contract like
so
that.
So Facebook, you know, it says, hey, you want a little piece of candy?
Right, exactly.
You want $20?
Come in my car, little boy.
Yeah. I mean, do they get parental consent? How does this happen?
From what I've seen, no, there was no parental consent gathered. They were just letting these teenagers install the software, and that was it. You know, the program effectively took over your entire phone. It wasn't just like, oh, it tracks you when you're using the Facebook app. Because of the way they distributed this, they were able to do it so that it took over your entire phone and watched what apps you were using, how you were typing. It could see literally everything on your phone.
Wow, this seems like a big story to me.
It's a big story that has not gotten much play in the media.
Chris, why don't we do some follow-up and come back to this story next week? There's a lot of different elements. Of course, as you're pointing out, one element is, you know, Apple is able to determine whether you can have or not have a particular app. The other story is that Facebook is, you know, seems to me, you know, this is a kind of manipulation of children.
Oh, absolutely. This is taking advantage of children.
I mean, why wouldn't this be abusive to children? You know, by some broader standard of abuse. I mean, let's say you're 13 years old, you're a 13-year-old child, and you're letting Facebook surveil on you. You're doing stuff and you're being surveilled about stuff that, you know, when you're 17, 18, 20, certainly when you're 30, 35, you're not going to want that out in the, you know, online world, and it's never going to come back to you. It's been taken from you. I mean, it seems to me to be just purely abusive. And again,
without
for predatory purposes. I mean, it's not like Facebook is trying to find a cure to cancer here. I mean, they're just trying to make money.
That's right. This is just about money. $20 per user per month is nothing to Facebook when you consider what it makes and how much it's spent to buy the technology that it developed this off of, which, you know, well over $100 million. This is called Project Atlas, is what it's called, if you've seen that reference in the media. I definitely think there is much more coming out on this. This is a big story that came out in tech media over the weekend, but I think there's going to be much more focus on it this week, and I'm particularly going to be looking into a number of things about it this week as well.
That's the voice of Chris Garofa. We talk to Chris every Monday in this segment called Technology Rules. Chris, we have 4 minutes left, and I know we want to spend at least the last 60, maybe 90 seconds on the tech tip. Let's go on then to our next story.
Oh, well, this is Google is turning into an urban planning company in addition to everything else.
Well, that was inevitable, wasn't it?
Let me rephrase that. Google is still an advertising company, but is going to do urban planning in order to sell advertisements and get the data to sell those advertisements. Google has Sidewalk Labs is the company name, but it's owned by Google's parent company, Alphabet. So Sidewalk Labs basically tries to do like this urban planning to help people, you know, to develop a smart city or smart neighborhoods effectively. Wow, the stuff they're tracking, down to tracking who people are by the way they walk. Of course, this requires having cameras everywhere. It requires having cell phone sensors, beacons that can, you know, ping off your cell phone without you even knowing it. We've talked in the past about how just our cell phones can tip off people, you know, anyone who has access to that data about not just where we are, but what our regular patterns are, right? We go to this gym, we work here, we live there, all of that. This would be that times 1,000. I was tipped off to this by Rethink Link NYC. We've talked in the past about those Link NYC kiosks that they're putting in that actually have cameras and Bluetooth and all of that put into them. This is taking that project in New York City, and Sidewalk Labs plan for this, which they don't have in any specific location yet, but their plan for this would be, I mean, really, we're talking about 1984 level surveillance everywhere in a city that implements this.
Chris Garofa is our guest. Chris, we have just under 2 minutes left. Let's go on with the tech tip for the week.
I got a really, really good question via email the other day from a listener, and The question was, you know, we talk about using Signal, we talk about using Firefox, we talk about ways to protect yourself, but what happens if somebody actually gets their hands physically on your phone or computer? You know, let's say going back to the TSA example, you go through airport security and they take your phone or your computer into a back room, or, you know, somebody steals your phone and you get it back later. You know, unfortunately, at that point, you can use Signal, you can use Firefox, but all bets are off when it comes to security. You know, unfortunately, if somebody has physical access to any of your devices, it's possible, and it's been done before, that particularly law enforcement or other private bad actors could install software that you can't even see on your phone or your computer to track what you're doing, to see who you're messaging in Signal and what you're doing on the internet and all of that. So I appreciate the listener for messaging me to ask that clarifying question. And definitely if folks are traveling and have secure information on their devices and they have had their device taken, particularly by law enforcement, you know, unfortunately, the best thing to do is to trash it and start over. Even wiping it may not be the best idea all the time.
Oh, you're talking about actually trashing it?
Actually trashing it, unfortunately, which can be a very expensive proposition.
Wow.
Maybe it's time for flip phones.
Yes. You know what? My brother and sister always made fun of me because I carried a flip phone until like 2013. But they're better. They're safer because you can't store anything on it.
10 seconds left. Chris Garofa, are they safer?
They are a bit safer because you can do a lot less on them.
We're going to leave it right there. Less is more in terms of privacy. Anyway, that's all the time we have. We were joined by Chris Garofa. He joined us from New Haven, Connecticut. He is a web developer and technologist. Chris joins us every week in this segment called Technology Rules. Stay with us. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.